is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Happy holidays, everyone. It was week 41 working from home still for many, a holiday-shortened trading week, and one where we saw a new COVID-19 strain and that much-talked-about long dark winter. It was upon us. COVID-19 understandably dominating our conversations. With that in mind, we checked in with the president of Morehouse School of Medicine on the virus and boosting Black physicians nationwide. Also, the president of Samsonite North America on surviving when no one was traveling. And those animal spirits running wild across Wall Street in the form of IPOs and SPACs. We catch up with someone who's taken several big companies public, Yex Steve Cakebread. He weighs in on that frenzy. We begin, though, with this week's cover story. It is a story about how, in a year of so many wrongs and wrongdoings, there is one thing that went really, really right this year. That story by Bloomberg News U.S. healthcare team leader Drew Armstrong, who, along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber, talked with Bloomberg Quick Take anchor Tim Stenovic and me.
Congratulations to Drew on his first cover story, it turns out, which is great for him. So much on it has just gone terribly, terribly wrong this year, and I think we all recognize that. And this is our good business issue, and it was a chance to actually reflect on a few things that actually were remarkable, and not least of which is what the vaccine represents, which is this Herculean undertaking that was, coordinated from multiple places. I mean, you had government doing something very right in this regard, but also, scientists who were basically doing their job and doing it really fast. And that was sort of what we turned to Drew about and said, by the way, let's just step back and like marvel at what was just achieved here. We had never seen a vaccine come to fruition this fast. Can you help us kind of put a bow around that? And ultimately, that bow looked like dry ice with a little vial of liquid. And, no, it is not real vaccine juice. But Miracle on Ice was the cover line.
I don't know if that's the
technical
term for it.
And, Drew, we did try to get the real bottle, right, Drew?
Yeah, I mean, we were, calling around the evening before the photo shoot, seeing if anybody would give us an empty, to be clear, bottle of Pfizer's vaccine, which was being used most heavily at the time. Unfortunately, no luck on that.
Kind of glad they didn't, because I'm hoping they're using the vial for the vaccine. Just going to put it out there, guys. So tell us about, though, this story is remarkable because one of the big things that you point out, Drew, is that the science was there. We were very lucky that the messenger RNA science was already in the works for several years.
Yeah, this is a technology that has been kind of kicking around in the biopharmaceutical world for a number of years, and people have always thought it held a tremendous amount of promise. It essentially turns, the idea is that it turns cells into little protein factories, and so you can kind of turn them into little mini drug manufacturers themselves, which is great theoretically, but it hadn't really delivered in a big way yet. Moderna is probably the most out in front company with this, but there had long been this idea that you could use it to rapidly make vaccines in a pandemic because of the speed with which you can design and begin producing these things. A lot of flu vaccines, people don't know this, they're essentially grown inside eggs. It it can take quite a long time to actually develop and test these things. But, the mRNA vaccines, they were designed in just a couple of days after Moderna and the NIH got a copy of the virus's genetics downloaded from China. So it's remarkable how fast this can happen and this technology getting things out front as quickly as it did.
I was shocked to read that, Drew, that it took only a couple of days. Yeah. So where is the, when it comes to vaccine development, where does the time hiccup? Is it the clinical testing? Is it the actual manufacturing of it? Where's the bottleneck?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is something I actually had a wonderful conversation with Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar about. He's a former Eli Lilly executive who worked there in the drug industry for a long time. And one of the things that we talked about in our discussion, and this is common throughout the pharmaceutical industry, is that when you're looking at laying out hundreds of millions of dollars or eventually billions of dollars potentially to bring a drug or a vaccine through trials, you know, you don't do everything at once. You do the initial preclinical work, and then you pause and you look at the results and you say, okay, let's go ahead to phase one. And then you do that work, and then you pause and you go ahead and you say, okay, let's go ahead to phase two. And, you know, so on and so forth up through clinical trials. And then you need to start thinking about, okay, we need to build manufacturing. How much do we need to build? This is a long process with a lot of consecutive steps. What happened with Warp Speed was essentially it took all of those and compressed them all down kind of into one big race from the word go. And it said, okay, we're going to build manufacturing. At the same time, we're going to run the phase three, you know, phase two and phase three trials. We're going to arrange short pre-purchase deals for these things. Basically, compressing steps that typically would take years and years and years to be due, partly because of the risk and high chance of failure involved with drug development, saying, do it all at once. And we'll put a bunch on the line here. You know, most of the drug companies involved were part of that program, Operation Warp Speed, to do that. Pfizer was not technically, but did very similar work in terms of compressing its timelines and was still first across the line here.
The miracle on ice that is the COVID-19 vaccines. That story from Bloomberg News U.S. healthcare team leader Drew Armstrong, who has kept us so informed during this health pandemic, and also Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber. They join Bloomberg Quick Take anchor Tim Stenovic and me. Check out that cover story and the cover image. So cool, literally and figuratively. It's on newsstands, online, and on the Bloomberg terminal. Coming up,
when your turn comes up, we want people to actually be ready to accept the vaccine.
Success in getting a vaccine? Check. Success in getting everyone to take it? Not so easy. The president of Morehouse School of Medicine weighs in. That's next on Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
This was a week that we talked about a new COVID-19 strain. We had some U.S. states reporting the highest number of deaths from COVID since the summer. Travel bans were back. And the U.S. government's top infectious disease doctor, Anthony Fauci, got the vaccine as part of an effort by health officials to build confidence in the shots. In keeping with all of that, Bloomberg Quick Take anchor Tim Stenovic and I talked with Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice. She's president and dean of Morehouse School of Medicine, the first woman to lead the Atlanta-based medical institution, who is also leading a new multi-million dollar initiative to increase the number of Black physicians nationwide. It's a move important to getting care out to the underserved Black communities. She kicked it all off, though, with an important reminder.
Well, first of all, I want to say I'm glad you're having this conversation, is that, first of all, the vaccine is not going to take care of everything for us, that we still have to continue these public health initiatives of washing our hands, wearing our masks, and watching our distance. With that being said, I am trying to move the conversation from one of vaccine hesitancy to vaccine acceptance. What we've seen is science at great work here. We know that we now have something that has been shown to be 94% to 95% effective in preventing the disease. That doesn't mean you don't get infected. What it means, though, when you have the vaccine in place, it is going to come, it's going to produce antibodies that are going to gobble up that virus so that you will not get ill. And so we still have more to know, but what we really do know is that it's safe and it's been shown to be very effective at that. So when your turn comes up, we want people to actually be ready to accept the vaccine because that is one of the ways that we can mitigate the ravages of this disease, of this illness, of this sickness that is really taking over our country right now.
Well, Dr. Rice, you are one of the very few people who actually has been able to get the first dose of this vaccine. You got it last week on CNN with Dr. Sanjay Gupta. I imagine you took the Pfizer-BioNTech one?
Yes, I got the Pfizer one, and I'm a person who, even though I'm a surgeon, I don't like needles. It was,
join the club. I'm not a surgeon, but I don't like needles.
I still wince.
It wasn't painful at all. It was less painful than the flu vaccine.
Okay. How did it feel afterward?
Totally fine. And so, you know, you go on to you sign up for this app and call VTAC or Be Safe. That's what it is. And every day I've been answering questions. I had a little bit of arm soreness. I haven't had any headaches, any nausea, any fatigue or anything. And so I felt really good.
That's good to hear, because even after the flu shot, I get a sore arm.
You do get a
flu. Yeah.
Was it cold going in?
A bit of a sore arm, but it wasn't. It's not as sore to me as it is when I have the flu vaccine. I get the flu vaccine every year, of course. I felt nothing. I mean, I was like, well, you saw it on air. I was like, okay, that's it. I was expecting a lot more. I think the needle is bigger than the solution.
Yeah, the needle looks kind of big. I'm going to look away, like, to be quite honest.
No, don't look, okay? And it's over.
Doctor's orders, okay, yeah. Carol?
I mean, you know, go with someone who knows how to give a shot, right? So you were like, okay, have you given a shot before? You know, we wanted to make sure of that. Well, but no, in all seriousness, here is an opportunity, you all. And I know people get concerned about warp speed.
Yeah.
You know, warp speed does not mean that there were any steps skipped. And I've had the privilege, you all, of looking at the data, phase 0, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 data, because I'm on one of the NIH panels. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that data. And now that Moderna and Pfizer have both released their phase 3 data, I've looked very intentionally at that. And so I can tell you the safety profile, it really did show that it was equally effective regardless of your race, regardless of your gender, regardless of your age, and regardless of whether or not you were obese. And that made a big difference to me, to saying, okay, they really did have great enrollment of people in the diversity in these trials.
I am curious, what are some of the dominant conversations you're having at Morehouse, you know, about COVID-19 right now?
Yeah, so the main dominant conversation was, you know, we did have originally 30% of our doctors or healthcare providers who were hesitant. That has decreased. We probably have vaccinated over 200 people now, 200 of our healthcare professionals. So that's been the biggest conversation. Okay, yes, we have the historical context of what has happened with blacks in clinical trials, et cetera, but that's not where we are now, you all. We're at a different phase in this country.
Dr. Rice, you shared with us and your team shared us some research and some information about how studies show that black patients have better outcomes when treated by black doctors. I get that. I have a lot of women doctors because I just feel more comfortable addressing things and talking about things. So you guys at Morehouse have instituted a program to address that, and that is a multi-million-dollar initiative to increase the number of black physicians nationwide. Talk to us about that program and why you're doing it, a little bit more about why you're doing that.
Thank you, Carol. Sure. So, you know, the dual pandemics of COVID-19 and racial injustice really magnified for us sort of the health disparities that were impacting the black community. And what we recognized a long time ago when we were founded, that in order to ensure that you have the highest level of compliance and cultural competence, there needed to be a shared governance between the patient and the provider, right? And so we have been working to ensure that there's representation of underrepresented minorities who care for patients from different communities. Right now, black clinicians only comprise about 5% of the physician workforce and 7% of all medical students. As we have been continuing to grow and have impact, Morehouse School of Medicine is partnering with Common Spirit. We recognize we had a shared commitment to the creation and advancement of health equity, particularly in that of underserved communities. As you may know, Common Spirit is the largest not-for-profit health system in the country. They're found in 21 states. They have over 140 hospitals. And because of this shared commitment, we have decided to partner together over the next 10 years through a $100 million initiative where we're going to address the underlying health disparities. But that is going to primarily focus initially on the underrepresentation of black clinicians. So when you look 5 to 7 years from now, you're going to see 5 new regional medical schools with Morehouse School of Medicine and Common Spirit name on them, allowing Morehouse School of Medicine to double its class size from 100 to 200. And then you're going to see 10 new residency training programs across the country. So we believe we're going to triple the number of black residents who graduate from a residency training program and go out and practice in the community. So the other great thing that Morehouse School of Medicine has a lot of experience with is pipeline programs, right? So we adopted an elementary school here in Atlanta called Tuskegee Airmen Global Academy, a K-5. Now, all we're trying to do there with those 600 students is engage them so they get to see us in white coats. They get to come to the school, et cetera. We're planting the seeds.
Strong people pipeline is so important in creating more diversity and equality throughout institutions, companies, and really our world overall. That's Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, President and Dean of Morehouse School of Medicine, talking with Bloomberg Quick Take anchor Tim Stenovek and me. That full conversation on our podcast feed. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, what do you do when your business is all about travel in a health pandemic? You get packing on some new ideas to reach consumers. The president of Samsonite North America fills us in. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
The hospitality industry and just about all of the companies associated with it have witnessed and are still living through a shutdown like they've never seen before. And any company associated with travel, well, they felt the downturn equally, like luggage maker Samsonite, who, as many other companies did during the pandemic, had to first cope with the unprecedented. More on that from Lynn Berard, president at Samsonite North America.
As it has been for everyone, it has certainly been a unexpected and quite busy, challenging year since March. One year that has been in the industry for 27 years and certainly has not experienced anything like it. But we immediately, upon the pandemic hitting in March, we had started to hear some sense of that from our team in China. So we got a little bit of a head start from our colleagues about what was happening in China. So we did immediately have to pivot. And at the very start of the pandemic, we really focused on our people just to make sure that everyone was safe and certainly thankful that our employees are healthy and well. But we did have to make some strategic shifts within the business. Certainly, number one priority was to really relook at our structure, knowing that there was a slowdown and ultimately pretty much a virtual stop to travel.
Right.
As a global company, we are extremely fortunate to have our CEO, Kyle Gendreau, who was previously our former global CFO for many years, leading us through. So him, along with our current CFO, Reza Taleghani, really worked hard to ensure that we secured the financial liquidity to weather the storm. And then regionally, it was really up to us to manage the regions, and very fortunate to have a very strong leadership team. But we did have to make sure that we looked at our cost structure and reevaluated the business to set us up for a very strong and stable future. And I'm very glad to report that we are all extremely confident and that we have set ourselves up in a strong position to get us to the other side. At the same time we were doing that, we certainly didn't want to lose sight of our consumers and recognizing that they had shifted more to an at-home environment and weren't traveling. We still wanted to be along the journey with them. So we found ways to communicate with them digitally in more unexpected ways, showing them how to exercise with luggage products. We made some
products. Can I just say, that is just, I can only imagine the virtual planning meeting, Lynn, where it's like, all right, guys, listen, nobody's traveling. That's our business. So what do we do? But how clever that someone's like, hey, like, and it's a great idea. I mean, I think all of us those who couldn't maybe afford to buy a Peloton or something else were like, all right, I'm looking around home. What can I use at home to work out?
Absolutely. And there was a shortage in buying some weights. So load up those suitcases and start lifting, right? So we did find creative ways to pivot around there. And then after that transformed, we actually did start to see, as we approached the summer months into the fall, that there was a shift to some more smaller localized movement around. And we are fortunate to have a broad portfolio of products. So our Gregory packs, the mountain hiking, and people were buying into those packs. So that business was not as tough as the travel suitcases happened to be, and really began to focus on ways that we could help consumers, even bags and backpacks. We also own Spec, and we saw an increase in tablet cases as consumers were shifting to working from home and saw a big spike in those. So we really just shifted into providing consumers and marketing to our consumers with products that they would need in the new environment.
How easy, though, was it to shift in terms of either marketing? I mean, I've talked to a fair amount of CMOs at some well-known brands, too, and they just were like, you know, all of a sudden it was like, all right, this advertising campaign just doesn't work anymore, and we have to quickly shift, and things that would normally take months.
That's exactly 100% correct. I think everybody had to adapt on a dime, and we all rotated quickly, and we were monitoring sales on a daily basis. One of the fortunate benefits of e-commerce and digital as well is you can see by minute what you're selling. So we were able to pivot very quickly. We have a very versatile team throughout the region, and we were able to really leverage all of those insights that we had to make sure that we were capitalizing where we could help consumers and travelers out there.
So Lynn, are there any consumer trends? Because we've talked to the CEO of Whirlpool and some others, and I was talking to another one on the phone, and just saying how some of the consumer trends that we're seeing this year, especially consumer patterns that stay with you for 7, 8, 9 months, they don't go away quickly or may not at all. Are there consumer trends that you're seeing that you think might impact how you guys, I don't know, your composition of your product line or how you sell? Is there anything that might have a longer term impact in terms of strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. So Samsonite has historically been known for a suitcase travel provider, but we have over the years developed a strong assortment of bags and accessories, and we have seen a significant uptick in those products during this downturn, and it really accelerated the lift in sales. And that will follow us for some time. And simultaneously, when travel does come back, we will start to see the lift of the travel suitcases coming back.
Yeah, that's something we're all trying to focus on when lockdowns end and our world moves back to being normal. That's Lynn Berard, president at Samsonite North America. Still ahead, as many companies like Samsonite struggled and then learned to pivot during the pandemic, it was full steam ahead when it came to IPOs and SPACs this year.
I'm excited to see the market come back, and hopefully we'll get others. And I know 2021 is lining up to be strong as well.
We check in with someone who took Yext, Pandora, and Salesforce all public. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Great story in the Bloomberg this week about how animal spirits are famously running wild across Wall Street, like how the first day return for IPOs averaged 40% this year, and how SPACs, special purposed acquisition vehicles that raise money for a blank check company to buy whatever it wants, have raised over $60 billion this year, more than the previous decade combined. So we talked about both with Steve Cakebread, CFO of Yext. He led the financial teams that took Yext, Pandora, and Salesforce all public. He definitely was into the animal spirits.
I'm excited to see the market come back, and hopefully we'll get others. And I know 2021 is lining up to be strong as well.
Yeah. Did it like surprise you, though, in a year that was just, you know, off the charts on so many levels, and, you know, the personal impact, the health impact, of course, of COVID, the economic impact, but yet to see such a strong IPO market?
Yeah, that's a great observation. You would have thought with macroeconomics and all the issues that we had elections too.
Right.
But I also think it talks to the strength of the capital markets and where companies that are growing and aspiring to get bigger and continue to grow, the access to capital in the public markets is the easiest and most efficient way to get there. And you also have different ways to get capital through debt offerings, convertible offerings, and the IPOs and SPACs and direct listing, as you mentioned. So I think what businesses started to see is it's time to get into the market and get access to the capital, because it's always there despite the heavy lift or load on pandemics and macroeconomics.
Well, what do you make, though? Yeah, God, I have so many questions for you. Is it at all akin to the IPO market that we saw back in 1999 to 2000? To me, having, you know, covered business news in the markets at that point, I think it's very different in terms of the companies that we're seeing come to market versus today. I also feel like we have a market that kind of smacks you down pretty quickly if you're not legit or there's problems.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I don't think this is the 1999, 2000 entries here where companies were coming to market a little too early or people didn't understand the business model. I think one of the big things about this market is, you're right, people are bringing real businesses. People do understand business models, and the investors can look into those and look beyond just what the macroeconomics are of a company, so long as they understand the long-term business model. So yeah, I feel this is very different. I think the market is also looking for growth opportunities, as you guys discussed on your show numerous times. And there is a change in innovation going on. So that's how new businesses get into the market with IPOs.
Well, what do you make of DoorDash and Airbnb this year? And we've had a lot of analysis about who ultimately is the longer play here. Some think it's DoorDash because they're so established in the marketplace when it comes to all of the online ordering. Airbnb will see whether people continue to use it once life gets back to normal. How do you see it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think some of the larger IPOs like DoorDash and Airbnb, one is they probably should have gone out earlier because people didn't get to participate in some of their growth. But now that they're out, people are saying, hey, I use these every day. I want to invest in them. I think there's a little bit of froth in the retail or individual investor side as people are learning, particularly individuals that haven't been in the market for all that long. Remember, they exited for a while. It was mostly institutional. So I think you're seeing a lot of individual investors learning how to invest in companies. And clearly, one of the ways to do that is invest in a company that you use. And certainly all of us have used some type of food delivery service.
Right.
And a lot of people were using Airbnb and the similar companies or companies to get out of the city. So I think it's investors investing in what they do and use. I'm a big fan of Starbucks, so I invest in Starbucks.
Right, right. It's like the old Peter Lynch model going way back when, right?
Yep.
Just, you know, invest in
exactly.
things you really, really understand or that you use. It's why, you know, it's interesting, and maybe I'm going in a little bit of a different direction, but all of the FANG stocks, and we constantly have conversations about overvaluation, and I'm not trying to pump them up any more than they have, but I use Amazon a lot. And when I go to buy something, it's usually the first place I look.
Yeah, exactly. I think you know, one of the investment strategies is to go where you go. And like you said, you use Amazon, you invest there. If you use some other service, you go there because you're supporting the company. You know what the company's doing. You also know how good or how bad their service might be. So I think that's for individual investors. I think that's really important to invest in where you spend your money day to day. You know, I talk a lot about to venture capital and entrepreneurs, get your company out public earlier because that discipline, that governance, the transparencies that come for being public also help your company to be more operationally efficient inside. And I think raises the value line of the company inside so people understand what they have to do. And that transparency does to a large degree show up earlier if you go public earlier.
Well, that's interesting, Steve, that you say that because there's so much money out there. And we do see whether it's an Airbnb or a DoorDash, they are able to stay private for a lot longer because they are able to do multiple funding rounds. Is that a good or bad thing?
Well, it's a good thing, but I also think it's a bad thing because I think you leave individual investors behind because the prices that go out are too high.
SoftBank getting in. I do wonder, is there a point when it comes to SPACs that we're all of a sudden saying, okay, we've hit a peak here? How do you see it, Steve?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Carol. You know what? Old is new, right? Because they've been around for a long time.
Yeah.
And there's been a ton of money raised into SPACs and the blank check companies this past year or so. And, you know, it really gets down to how you want to take or what you need in your company to get it public. Because at the end of the day, SPACs, direct listings and other things do end up being public. I do think that one has to be careful because there's a lot of different people that lead these SPACs, and you have to make sure their investment, if you will, standards are high enough to meet your investor needs. And then also, it's really a question, are there really enough companies out there to be bought with that type of money at this point? So we'll see how that plays out. Everybody has a two-year window. And the clock's ticking when you go raise that money. So we'll see what happens.
Well, this is what I wonder, Steve. I mean, there is so much money out there. And we talked about this a little bit more, you know, earlier about these IPO company, you know, companies that ultimately IPO. They've been around for a few years. So we've gotten used to them. We've heard about them. We've gotten to see kind of them grow their business and understand their financials better. But I do wonder when there's so much money chasing, maybe when there, you know, too few deals, you know, ultimately what kind of instability or, you know, a skewed equation that we ultimately get in the marketplace?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. We've seen the run-ups in the companies we talked about, you know, DoorDash and Airbnb and others. And I think that's where investors have to be a little bit cautious. You can pay too much for something and you can wait for the vision because you're investing in the longer-term vision. So the question is how much you're paying today for that longer-term vision and how long is it going to take to achieve that result? So, yeah, there's a lot of money chasing this, and I think individual investors just need to be cautious about what they're doing with their money when they invest in these.
I mean, why does someone like SoftBank that has a lot of money do a SPAC? And I should point out that the head of the Vision Fund originally revealed plans for the SPAC in an interview they did with Bloomberg News at the Milken Institute virtual conference back in October. So we knew this was coming. But why do they need to do this? I mean, same thing with hedge fund investor. I mean, is it just because it's a great vehicle to make some fast money? I don't know.
Well, it's a great vehicle to make money potentially, but I do think it's because there's an open market or open window here for folks like SoftBank and other hedge funds to go raise money. Because remember, raising money is job one here. And right now it's easy to raise money, low interest rates, a lot of confusion in the marketplace. So I view the SPACs and the hedge funds and SoftBank doing this as just another vehicle for them to raise money as opposed to go out and look for limited partners or other individual investors to get into their funds.
Hey, one thing I want to ask you, big picture, you've worked at a lot of different well-known companies, look at this market, have seen the ups and downs in terms of cycles. You know, I mentioned at the kick at the beginning of our interview about a story that's running on Bloomberg about the animal spirits running, you know, wild across the street. So we've got great market for financial markets, but it's not been a great year for humans. I mean, we have just incredible inequities and just the gaps. What will potentially be the consequences of all of that?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And when I talk to people and in institutions and investors, I think there's a disconnect between what the market's doing and, quite frankly, what our neighbors are suffering through here. And, you know, my family's in a business that depends on the restaurant business. And, boy, when you don't have that type of market, it's tough to run these businesses these days. So I think we need to be cautious because although there's euphoria around the vaccine, there's a lot of unknowns coming from that. And I think I kind of look at this as it's going to be a tough market for the next couple of years simply because there's so many people out of work and we need to get those people back to jobs and back to work to have a really robust economy.
Yeah, exactly. And there needs to be, you know, more of that wealth distribution that we've talked about.
Exactly.
All right. Last note, a little bit of a lighter note, but I hope it's lighter because I don't know how it's been going. But you are also the co-owner and founder of Cake Bread Cellars in Napa Valley. How has that been going?
Well, I'm going to give my credit to my parents. They founded it. I just got to work there and enjoy the experience and obviously taste the wine. But the wineries, you know, like I said, in Napa Valley, with the openings and closings that the state has put on them, most of us sell to restaurants.
Yeah.
And the restaurant business obviously is in difficult shape right now. But I think everybody is trying to keep their workforce employed because that's job one.
Right.
And you change how you do business. We do a lot more internet sales. I will say that, you know, online purchases of wines of all ilk are probably doing pretty well these days. I know I'm always online trying to buy more wine. You know, just to get you through the day.
Ah, wine. Yes, indeed. I've got some firsthand experience on that. That was Steve Cakebread, CEO of Yext. He's also author of the IPO Playbook, an insider's guide on taking your company public and how to do it right. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser. Coming up in the next hour, a sign that the ESG movement is too big to ignore. There's a backlash. And speaking of backlash, Black Americans pushing back against taking a vaccine and with good historical reasons. Bishop Wayne T. Jackson of the Impact Network on building medical trust within the Black community. And why holiday entertaining this year is so complicated and what we can do. And we'll wrap up with a partnership between jewelry designers and the sustainable diamond industry in Botswana. That's all coming up on Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Masser. Coming up in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week in this holiday-shortened trading week, we've got some of this week's highlights from our daily radio broadcast and podcast, including building trust in the COVID-19 vaccine within the Black community.
We're going to have to get community leaders out. It's going to take community leaders, it's going to take the faith-based community.
Bishop Wayne T. Jackson, CEO of the Impact Network, weighs in on that. Plus,
people cannot wait to have something to celebrate, even if it's going to be virtually, and also just to kick this year out the door.
Why holiday entertaining this year? It's complicated. Well, we know why, but we've got some helpful thoughts from Pursuit's food editor, Kate Crater, to get you through it. And what do you get when you bring De Beers, Blue Nile, and Botswana together? We kick off this hour with a story in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week by Bloomberg Economics editor Peter Coy. He writes about a company's responsibility to multiple stakeholders, you know, like the things ESG investors care about. What Peter found out is that there's a backlash against prioritizing anything other than profits. Here's more from Peter, who joined Bloomberg Quick Take anchor Tim Stenovec and me.
It's certainly true that ESG investing is on the rise. There's a survey by Deloitte that found that something like 26% of professionally managed assets in the U.S. had ESG mandates as of 2018, versus only 11% in 2012. That's a pretty rapid increase. And as you said, it's engendering a backlash, and we're seeing it in the Trump administration. Three different agencies have taken shots at ESG in different ways in the final months of Trump's term in office. Now, Biden may try to reverse some of them, not all, but in any case, it represents, obviously, the Trump administration doing this because they're feeling some heat, and that's probably coming mostly from corporate America that is resisting some of the ESG mandates.
So in corporate America, where is the backlash coming from? Because I thought ESG was all the rage right now.
Well, that's, I mean, it's true. It's a mixed picture, I think, and that's a fair point. There are a lot of companies that are totally on board with ESG, but in some cases, they just don't like being pinned down. They want to have sort of the freedom to do it their way. Anyway, to give you some examples, the most stringent restrictions on ESG are coming from the Labor Department, which makes a certain amount of sense because the Labor Department is in charge of pensions. Mm-hmm. And naturally, pensioners are vulnerable to bad investing, and they're relying on that money for their retirement. They really don't directly have anything to say over where the money is invested. So the Labor Department sort of bends over backwards to say that the money should be invested only according to pecuniary considerations, money, not ESG. The ESG could be used only if there's a two exactly equal investments from a profitability point of view. ESG could be the tiebreaker, and they expect that to be a rare situation.
So it's interesting. There's a line in your story, Peter. A cynical take on ESG is that it's a way for CEOs and boards to avoid accountability. If profits come in below expectations, they can point to some wind farm as an explanation, like, hey, we did the right thing, but it hurt profits.
Right, yeah. So I have a quote in the article from a woman named Barnali Chowdhury, who's at UCL in London, kind of on this point, saying, you don't want ESG to be sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card for companies, you know, to just wave your hands and say, we're answering to multiple stakeholders, not just shareholders.
Well, you know, I think about Jamie Dimon, right, at the Business Roundtable, and of course of J.P. Morgan. Like, you know, when he made that statement about, listen, companies have to have multiple stakeholders. I think everybody was like, it's shareholders, it's employees, it's your community, it's a lot of things that we need to think about. But I do wonder, you know, ultimately, if you're a publicly held company, right, ultimately you still answer to your shareholders.
Yeah. Well, Carol, this is such a deep issue. We could talk about it all day long because there's so many nuances here, but there is that argument. But then the argument of the ESG people is, look, shareholders could collectively decide that they want some objective other than just making money. They collectively want to do something about climate change, for example. Mm-hmm. And the argument would be, fine, if that's what they vote.
Right.
They choose a board of directors that wants that. If they vote in proxies for that kind of thing, then they're certainly entitled to.
So is Milton Friedman right here, right? The social responsibility of business is to increase its profits.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Is like it's a very clean storyline, the Milton Friedman one. What I'm getting at is that there's a lot of ambiguity in corporate law, and maybe that's not an entirely bad thing. Mm. Maybe we need to learn to live with a certain amount of ambiguity. And I tell the story of going back to Barnali Chowdhury citing a 18th century play called Servant of Two Masters, the servant named Truffaldino, who somehow manages to, by scrambling left and right, serve two different masters, and fairly ably as well.
Peter's story, something to chat about virtually, perhaps with friends and family over this holiday weekend. Again, that was Bloomberg Economics editor Peter Coy, who joined Bloomberg Quick Take anchor Tim Stenovic and me. Coming up, our world is about multiple stakeholders this year and being more inclusive. That includes building trust between the Black and medical communities. More with the CEO of the Impact Network. That's coming up. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Back with us this week, a voice we've reached out to several times during the pandemic, Bishop Wayne T. Jackson. He is founder and CEO of the Impact Network. It's a privately owned African-American inspirational television network. It's got an audience of some 90 million in the U.S. You can find it on Dish Network, DirecTV, Comcast, Xfinity, and a lot more. Well, Bishop Jackson joined us once again from Detroit, where we talked about building trust in the COVID-19 vaccine within the Black community, something we heard about earlier from the president of Morehouse School of Medicine. We began with Bishop Jackson talking about the recent COVID cases.
Detroit, we have had a spike in the past, after the post-Thanksgiving and the holidays, people traveling and coming back and forth from visiting the relatives. And it has been a spike. It has been, matter of fact, a devastation. We lost our sheriff, one of our county sheriffs, was well-known, beloved all around the city and the county. And, you know, he went in with COVID about maybe a week and a half ago and put him on a ventilator. Prayers were going up for him. We thought he would, you know, maybe make that turn, but he didn't. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
So many cases like that in the community.
Well, you know, I just did out, I put out on Twitter a poll, and I just said, because I'm kind of curious, and I've seen some of the polls out there, will you get the COVID-19 vaccine? Simple question. Yes, no, still deciding. And I think there is, as you know, a lot of polling out there that when it comes to the Black community, the minority community, that people are really nervous about taking this vaccine. What are you hearing? What are you seeing?
Well, I can't speak for the whole community, but I can say this. I have taken a poll also, and I have a dual role as a pastor of a large congregation in the city of Detroit, plus the founder of the Impact Television Network, as you said, that's in over 90 million homes. So I'm in touch with a lot of pastors, African-American pastors around the country. And the consensus has been that people really are leery about that vaccine. Now, I haven't had one person that I have come in contact with that said that they want to take, you know, take the vaccine.
You know, and listen, there's history there that you understand some of the nervousness within the Black community in terms of our past and our history and the Black community being used basically, you know, to test, you know, various medical treatments or you know, without their knowing or, it, you know, it's just kind of horrific when you think about it. Is that the crux of why Black Americans are hesitant, or what are you hearing specifically about that?
Well, you know, you go back to 1932.
Exactly.
Tuskegee situation with, the syphilis and giving the Black men to see how, males to see how it would react, even though they had a cure for it, and even though they, you know, asked him and persuaded him not to even go and get any other type of medical care, and they just died. You know, syphilis was a very terrible disease that caused a lot of pain. And so the way that a lot of African Americans feel is that they feel that the government is not on their side. They feel like, you know, again, that this is a government that had taken and advocated slavery and taken them from their homeland and putting them in chains and taking them over, you know, ships and bringing them over here, stripping them of their names and giving them a different name. So it's a lot of history behind that of mistrust. And so what we have here, they thinking that the community thinking that, you know, you want to use me as a guinea pig. You know, I heard people say, well, you can't get rid of the common cold, you can't get rid of the common flu, and now you take this within 7-8 months and you get a cure for something without even going through the regular protocol of even using animal testing, and now you want to put it on the people, and then, you know, they're very, very leery of it.
What can you do? What can local leaders do? What can a President Biden come January or Dr. Fauci do right now to have some influence over the Black community when it comes to the COVID-19 vaccine?
Well, let me say this. First of all, it's unfortunate that this is happening as far as the people who really need the help. As you know, that the death rate is very high when it comes to the African-American community, and they're, you know, impacted in such a negative way when it comes to deaths and even people who have not really who beat the COVID-19, but yet they don't have their full capacity of breathing and also being able to be normal again. So we're the only African-American faith-based Christian network, and we feel this responsibility to help get the message out in such a way of educating the people. When you go back to...
But what progress have you made so far? Because you would think that the Black community would trust an organization like you, but it just sounds like, and yours, excuse me, but it sounds like there is still a lot of distrust out there. So how do we kind of change that?
Well, it's going to be education. I mean, you got to educate them. That first of all, it's not going to, Vice President Pence he got the test, and the Surgeon General, he had the test, and then Biden had the vaccine.
Thank yep. you. That's okay.
The vaccine.
A lot of testing going on, too, so that's fair.
Yes, right, yeah. We've been talking about testing so long, now we're talking about the vaccine. But it's not going to turn the minds of the average African-American on the street in the community. What you're going to have to do, we're going to have to get community leaders out. It's going to take community leaders, it's going to take the faith-based community, the pastors, because the people that sits in their pews, they trust their pastor. So it's going to have to come a long educational process to get people to really understand that the vaccine is safe. And we asked what Biden, the president-elect, could do when he becomes president. They're going to put funds out there that can, you know, get the community aware of the vaccine, how the vaccine is safe, and things like that. It's going to take that grassroots type of effort to really change the minds of the people.
But it's not happening?
No. Not in a way that you would want it to help. And we know it. And when you look at this, you look at, you know, you're talking about virtual learning. Then when you have computers, then we have internet, and you know they're falling behind. And it's always look like it's the African American, the people of color that suffers the most. It's just going to have to be. And I believe that Biden is going to, and this is my personal feeling, that he's going to be more sensitive to these matters, because until we get there, you talked about George Floyd. But George Floyd, that was a tipping point. It brought a lot of awareness, because this has been going on. It's just not started.
They didn't just start, as we've talked about often on our broadcast, and we know a lot of work that still needs to be done. Bishop Wayne T. Jackson, founder and CEO of the Impact Network. Still to come, why is it all so complicated, including holiday entertaining?
It really is like trying to find good things to say about the Titanic. It's been like a devastating, horrible year for restaurants, and it keeps getting worse.
That's coming up next. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
We're bringing you some of this week's highlights on our daily radio show and podcast, including one of my favorite people to talk with, Bloomberg Pursuit's food editor, Kate Crater. She's our go-to in all things food, dining trends, and the chefs and restaurants behind it all. Kate talked with us about holiday entertaining this year, which, like so many things in our world, is rather complicated.
It really is like trying to find good things to say about the Titanic. It's been like a devastating, horrible year for restaurants, and it keeps getting worse. And, I got to report on a story that talked about how while indoor dining is shut in New York, it's still totally open across state lines in New Jersey, and even in like Westchester and the Hamptons, they're at like 25% and 50% capacity, and it's making chefs here in New York just tear their hair out.
Well, and, you know, we talked about that story on air because it was kind of interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do you get your head around that you can't have a restaurant open in New York or indoor, but you can in New Jersey, right? It's like, it's a little crazy, but it is allowing, I guess, some restaurant owners to have a little bit more business, I'm hoping.
Yeah, no, I think this guy, Ed McFarland, who has Ed's Lobster Bar, said that even though his place that's in SoHo in New York has been shut, his business in the Hamptons is up like 60%. And then some of these other people, as you might have talked about, they're trying to incentivize people to come to eat in New Jersey. Like David Burke said, he would pay people's tolls if they came to his restaurant in Fort Lee, I think. And then Jeffrey Bank, who has Carmine's. I love Carmine's. It's this family-style Italian restaurant, which is at the Tropicana in Atlantic City. He's worked out a deal with the hotel, so rooms are like $44 if you go and eat at the restaurant. And he rightly said that's about how much it costs to park your car.
Jeez.
if you're in New York City. So they're definitely trying to make the best of the challenging situation.
Well, right. And I guess we all are approaching. I was just texting with somebody about the holidays, and they're like, I'm not going to see any of my family. You know, it's just, you know, I'm not seeing my grandkid. Like, it's not business as usual when it comes to holidays. Your story, though, gives me some hope, because you always, you know, you always somehow find some optimism. And so, like, what's our gut? Like, what do we do here in terms of entertaining? How do we approach it? What are some of the things that you found out for your story?
One thing we found out is that people cannot wait to celebrate the holidays here and around the world. Christmas tree purchases started earlier than ever, and Christmas tree prices are up a little bit because there's like a bidding war going on with them. But I think even in November, people were like going up to places where they sold Christmas trees and starting to order them. And then in England, I thought this was kind of cool. There was like a rush on Christmas puddings in late September.
That is wild. So that's called starting really early.
I know, but it just shows that people, I think people cannot wait to have something to celebrate, even if it's going to be virtually, and also just to kick this year out the door. You know, it's just been so challenging for almost everybody.
I agree with you. I just need some tradition, something that reminds me of kind of the way it was, because it's hard to remember the way it was at this point. Here we are, you know, almost a year in with all of this. What about, you know, Kate, I thought it was interesting in your story. I guess there are people who will be ordering out from restaurants, right, during the holidays.
Yeah, that's some intel that came from Comcast, and they were looking at how people plan to spend money, and 48% said they were they want to support local business by ordering restaurant takeout, which is a really nice number. And another thing that's like hopeful is Prosecco sales are booming here. They were up 27%, over $100 million compared to last year.
Perfect little drink, isn't it? You can do so much with it.
Anything sparkling. So, yeah, no, I encourage everybody to grab a bottle of sparkling wine and start celebrating the holidays, and you'll be right in time with what everybody else is doing.
Listen, we've talked with you, too. I mean, people are doing a lot of cooking at home, and I'm assuming that's going to be a big part. That's where people can find some joy, certainly, this holiday season.
That's exactly true, although if they don't want to, there's also been so many restaurants, and especially ones here in New York now, they're doing some pretty deluxe meal kits.
Wow.
So you can get the 11 Madison Park one has gotten some attention. It's a duck. I think it costs $475. But by all accounts, I mean, I think you get leftovers with it. And but it's a way to go big. But almost any restaurant you can think of, Dan Barber at Stone Barns is doing some really in-demand meal kits. In San Francisco, Dominique Crenn has Atelier Crenn, and she does some fun ones. It has like a caviar tart, and her staff do these really fun instructional videos that come with it. So you sort of feel like you're talking. It's like going into the kitchen and meeting the pros and having them talk through your meal. So there are, as you were saying, like there's definitely some ways to make the best of a very challenging situation.
Leave it to Bloomberg Pursuit's food editor, Kate Crater, to always find some optimism in our world. She really is the best and a must read for anyone interested in food and restaurants. Straight ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, helping out an emerging economy and reimagining the engagement ring all in one. The details on a partnership between De Beers and Blue Nile. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser from Bloomberg Radio.
Big, well-known brands are increasingly reaching out to communities, and we see that with the 1010 program that is bringing together independent jewelry designers and the natural diamond industry in Botswana, getting ready to debut a collection come January. To explain, Stephen Lucier, Executive Vice President, Consumer Markets Chairman and Chairman of Forever Mark at De Beers Jewelers, joined us from London, along with Sean Kell, CEO of Blue Nile, who was in Seattle. But like many of our guests, we began with how their worlds were impacted by COVID.
Similarly to Stephen's experience, Blue Nile had a pretty remarkable year. I'm only here at Blue Nile for about a year and a half, so I picked a particularly interesting time, I think, to enter the jewelry industry. So it's been crazy, frankly. But we've had a really good second half of the year. The beginning of the year was pretty challenging, I think, as it was for most folks, both business and all of our employees around the country, and we have employees in Europe and China as well. So it's pretty scary, frankly. But the last several months have been very strong for our business. We've seen a number of consumers shift from bricks and mortar purchases to online, and that's very good for our business. And we've been able to expand our assortment, and I think provide great jewelry and diamonds to consumers looking for something special in these remarkable times.
Yeah, consumers have definitely pivoted. And if you weren't going digital, you are probably increasingly at this point. I know all of our shopping for the holiday season is completely online. It often is, but it's even more so this year. So, Stephen, tell me about this 10-10 program that you guys are doing together.
Well, I'll tell you, when we back up now sort of 6 months ago, and when we were in the really middle of the lockdown, and there was one point in time where most of the stores, jewelry stores in the world were closed, the mines were closed, the Indian cutting centers were closed, all because of COVID. But we knew we would come out of it. So we began to think at that time, what can we do for the people that are particularly dependent on diamonds and also those likely to have a harder time withstanding the lockdown? Big companies like De Beers, we can come through these things. But when you think about smaller jewelry designers, mm-hmm. and when you think about a country like Botswana that really is largely dependent upon diamonds, Botswana is in many ways the success story of Africa in terms of its economic development, but built on the use of diamond revenues. And so at De Beers, we were thinking, when we do come out of it, who do we need to help? And I guess the two that stood out for us was first, of course, Botswana, our partner in our largest mines. And secondly, these independent designers who are clearly going to have a tough time. And we thought that they had something that would be, I think, of particular interest as well to consumers looking to get married after and committed after lockdown, but wanting to do it in the way that was perhaps a bit more individual and a bit more expressive.
And Sean, I want to pick up with you because these collaborations are being sold exclusively, with Blue Nile, and I think they're going for about 3,000 to 4,000. Tell me what you're seeing so far in terms of they've started selling, correct?
Not yet.
Not yet. Carol.
They're going to launch. Yeah, they're going to launch in January.
Forgive me.
Kicking off the. That's okay. That's okay. We've got a lot of interest so far. I can tell you not only from folks we've provided a sneak peek to through our email programs, but also I can tell you our employees are pretty excited about them too. This 1010 collection is a first of its kind partnership for Blue Nile. We've been selling diamond engagement rings online for about 20 years, but we've never done a collection quite like this. And we're really excited to be partnering with De Beers on this program. It's a wonderful opportunity to support these terrific designers. There are 10 designers, as Stephen mentioned, and each are producing 10 diamond engagement rings. They're affordable, as you mentioned, $3,500 to $4,500 each. And they are stunningly beautiful. And this is what consumers want right now. Amazingly beautiful, natural diamonds in unique settings. And also, it gives us a really terrific opportunity. And we're very proud to highlight Botswana and the wonderful work that is being done there and these terrific stones that come from this beautiful place.
Well, tell us about these sustainable diamonds. That's what they are specifically. Sean, tell us about them and the distinction between other diamonds that are potentially sold in the marketplace.
Well, so Stephen can chime in here as well. He's really the diamond mining expert. But these particular stones all come from Botswana. Mm-hmm. They're ethically sourced. They conform to the highest standards of sustainable production and all the way through the supply chain from the earth to the settings and then to our consumers' hands. And it's really a terrific story about a wonderful partnership between the folks of Botswana and the entire De Beers, the entire supply chain all the way through to a retailer like Blue Nile.
Well, Stephen, come on in, chime in here, because I do think sustainability, this is certainly something I have had a lot of conversations, whether it's the head of the company that owns IKEA or some of the major consumer product companies, Patagonia. Like, we are talking increasingly about sustainability, circularity. Consumers increasingly are demanding this.
I think it is very much going to be a big part of the entire luxury goods industry's future. I mean, this concept of you know, at De Beers we call social purpose the new status. It's, I think, a fundamental part of consumers' selection process when they think about products to buy and brands. And I think that's where the story of diamonds in Botswana in particular is so compelling. I mean, Botswana, a very small country, but it is the world's leading producer of natural diamonds. And they've had an extraordinarily positive impact on the people of that country, both in terms of education, in terms of health care, and in terms of really just raising their living standards. I mean, before diamonds, De Beers discovered diamonds in the mid-1960s in Botswana. Before then, it was the world's poorest country. Today, it's a middle-income country, largely due to great governance and use of those diamond revenues. 80%, literally 80% of the revenues that come from the diamond mines flow back into the communities in Botswana, and it's a great good. And, of course, when we talk about circularity, I mean, you know, the expression a diamond is forever is clearly the case. You know, diamonds you buy and you keep for your whole life. There can be nothing that in many ways is more circular than that. They never disappear. They get handed on to new generations. So we think it's, in a way, an exciting time for the natural diamond story and for people who maybe don't know about the positive impact that they have, to have an opportunity through this program to learn more about this amazing country and what they've done with their diamond revenues.
Well, I'm just going to say I've been on the Blue Nile website and I've signed up to get some of the emails about the 1010 collection, but it's been fascinating to kind of read over some of the designers. You know, I do want to ask you, Sean, in terms of buying things like diamond jewelry online, we have seen an increased digitization of our world when it comes to retail. This is your world. What has the pandemic changed in terms of people buying kind of expensive items? I've talked with folks in the watch, the high-end watch industry, and they actually would do virtual kind of shopping with customers so that they could talk to somebody face-to-face before they made a purchase. But what changed in terms of selling kind of luxury goods online because of the pandemic?
Sure, I think a couple of things, Carol, have changed over this year. One, in terms of the product, and then second, in terms of how consumers are shopping. So in terms of the product, earrings have been selling like crazy, especially expensive, very high-quality diamond stud earrings. If you can imagine living in a Zoom world, diamond earrings are a wonderful, and earrings in general, are a wonderful way to show off your personality and to have something special. And in particular, these beautiful diamond stud earrings we have have been selling like they never have.
Right.
In terms of how people shop, we've really seen a much, first of all, just an increase in the number of shoppers. We've had record visits to our website, both in the U.S. and in the 44 other countries across the world where we offer and sell wonderful jewelry. But we've also seen folks calling into our call centers and a pretty dramatic increase in virtual shopping.
So great to hear from another member of the retail world finding a way to reach consumers and help others. That's Stephen Lucier, Executive VP, Consumer Markets Chairman, and Chairman of Forevermark at De Beers Jewelers, along with Sean Kell, CEO of Blue Nile. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser. Be sure to tune in daily to Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday, starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. You can also hear more of our Bloomberg Business Week conversations. Download them at Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also watch us on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News. And be sure to check out our Bloomberg Business Week Extra about a favorite topic and one that constantly pops up on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com. It's about real estate and about the high-profile moves to Austin from the likes of Elon Musk, Oracle, and others. For some thoughts on that, we caught up with Ari Rostegar, founder and CEO at Austin, Texas-based Rostegar Property Company, who was, as you might have guessed, in Austin. Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now, online, and of course on the Bloomberg. Have a safe weekend, everyone. Happy holidays. This is Bloomberg.